And I'd like to thank everybody else who's read again, helped us open the meeting. Take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started, and a particular welcome to any visitors to our meeting this evening, and a huge welcome to any newcomers that are with us tonight. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we, as I say, we are a speaker meeting, and it falls on me to introduce our speaker this evening. So I met this particular individual a couple of 3 weeks ago. We've had a few interesting conversations. I think he's got a really fascinating story to tell us about his recovery. He's been around a day or three. He's going to share for 40 or 45 minutes on his experience, strength and hope, his journey to, through and in recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. So without further ado, I'm going to hand you over to Jim H. from Philly, who's going to share with us. And I've unmuted you, Jim. So the floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Steve. My name is Jim, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Jim.
Welcome.
Hi, Jim.
Welcome.
Hello, folks. Steve, thank you for asking me to do this. And as I was listening to the readings, I knew that there'd be a number of people from the UK and England and Scotland, and I'm kind of struck by the people who sound like you're from the United States. I have a fairly good ear and trying to figure out where people are from, and I found it really interesting listening to the readings. And besides you, Steve, I want to thank the group for being here. You know, one of the things that I like to do and do probably every time I speak somewhere is to find out about the history of the group and the area. And I was really, really amazed because I kind of thought, you know, I say periodically, I came up with this a while ago, that most people, I think most people in NA think that NA began the day before they got here. They just have no idea, no interest perhaps in the foundings of NA and what NA was like the day before they were here. And I guess that's called self-centeredness or something. So I was struck by talking to Steve and finding out about the group that this actually goes back over 10 years. And in my mind, I think, well, geez, you know, this format started a year ago with COVID. And to think that you guys have been doing it for 10 years is absolutely amazing and fantastic. And I can understand the need to, and the reason now that I think about it, why it happened when it happened, and maybe even before you guys somewhere in the world. So thank you guys for doing this. It's absolutely wonderful. I can picture, you know, maybe people on ships out in the Atlantic or in the Pacific tuning into this meeting, or it's just so wonderful, this format. I don't know if I can go 40, 45. I guess I could go 40 or 45 minutes. Typically, I don't. I'll see what happens. I've been trying to get to your part of the world for a while, and I've been around the edges. For some reason, the Outer Hebrides has always, like, just parked my interest in, and just sounded so wonderful and so remote in Shetlands. Yeah, it just sounded like it's out there. Well, and I'll get into it. I lived in Iceland. I've been to Faroe. I lived in Denmark. I'll talk about that, I guess. But the Outer Hebrides have always sparked my interest. And I don't like to use the word bucket list because bucket list to me means that someone is old, and I can't think of myself as being old. You know, I'm up there. I'm aged. So it's probably, you know, and I've been all many places in the world. It's probably somewhere like between number 5 and 10 that I would like to get to. Typically, I hit Europe every year, sometimes twice a year. And by no means am I rich. I save every penny I get. And Jay was talking, and Jay and Steve were talking about taxes before the meeting began. And my tax refund money goes to buying a ticket and anything else I save during the course of the year. So I envy you people who live there. I can only imagine it's as beautiful as Iceland or as beautiful as Faroe Islands. So hopefully I'll get there someday. So with all that being said, I was just, you can tell from my accent that I'm not from Scotland, or I'm not from England, not from the UK. Born and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which, if you're trying to place it on a map, is about 100 miles south of New York City. At one time, it was the original capital of the United States. At one time, I think when I was born, it was the third or fourth largest city in the country. Now I think it's has decreased to maybe seventh or eighth. I think Houston is ahead of Philadelphia now, about 1.5 million people. And I live right outside of Philadelphia, but I was born and raised in Philadelphia and consider myself a Philadelphian. And I live in the next county outside of Philadelphia. And I was born into one of those homes that was absolutely wonderful. Great parents, wonderful parents, loving parents, caring parents. Just typical American parents at that time, and I was youngest of three children. I was the my brother about 7 or 8 years older than I am, and my sister 6 or 7 years older. And the reason why there's a space is because my father went to war, and when he came back, it was the beginning of the baby boomers, and here I am. So I'm part of that generation. I was saying to someone recently, and I say this from time to time, when I was coming up and came of age, I thought of myself as a hippie. Well, I really wasn't a hippie. I was just a dope fiend. I kind of looked like a hippie, I guess. I had long hair, had a mustache, had great love beads, and did all kinds of music and everything. In fact, that's kind of how I even got into getting high. Everything was wonderful. In the fact, I played all sports, especially football and especially American football. And I loved American football because I loved hitting people, blocking people, hitting people, tackling people. I just thought that that was so outstanding. And I played position of center and or guard, maybe tackle. And baseball, I apparently I excelled. I was on an all-star team, and it was a ended up being a pitcher, and played soccer, real football, a little basketball, tennis. I did everything. I was all, an all-American kid, and everything was wonderful. I mean, everything was absolutely, it was textbook happiness where I grew up. Until 2 weeks before I was 12, and it was the worst event of my life, the worst emotional event of my life. My father died suddenly. I mean, suddenly. I mean, he had a massive MI, a heart attack, and he just died. And God, I went from, my hero, and he was my hero. We did everything together. And I mean everything together. We went every, if he was going to the store, Jim, get in the car, we're going. Or if I wasn't, he was very involved in my sports and founded the first official Little League in Philadelphia. And if I wasn't playing baseball that day, or he was involved in the field, we would just go over. And that's what happened the night he died. We just went over to the game and came back, and shortly thereafter he died. And man, that was, as I said, the most worst emotional event of my life. So in today's world, they would have had me in counseling like an hour and a half after he died. Then that things like that didn't happen. And God bless my mother, she did everything she could do to help the pain. Her brother, my uncle, would come once a week after work, and we would do things, and she certainly was there for me. But there was this hole in my heart, this hole in my soul, this hole in my body that needed to be filled. And I found the way to fill it, or at least I thought I found the way to fill it. When I was 13 years old, one of my older cousins fact, she might have been my oldest because I don't remember. I got married, and there was the wedding ceremony after the wedding reception. And the grown-ups at the reception thought it'd be cute if they fed this 13-year-old kid some Manhattans, to the tune of 13 Manhattans. And 13 Manhattans in to 13-year-old kid, you know, it's a wonder I didn't die of alcohol toxicity. I was just really, really ripped, and I loved it. I mean, it was a feeling I had never experienced before. And those days in the States of where I lived, that was the drug of choice. At that time, the only people who were getting high on drugs other than alcohol, and I'm talking about opiates because that basically was it. There was some cocaine, as I have learned and educated myself and found out when I started getting high. But the only people in the States and Philadelphia that were getting high were like old black guys who were shooting dope in inner city area and listened to John Coltrane and and Miles records, and white kids weren't getting high except on alcohol. And damn, I was on my way. You know, alcohol, if I didn't found other drugs, that would have been my drug of choice. Because I filled myself up on Friday nights and Saturday nights and Sunday and whenever I could during the week if possible and needed. And that's the way it was going. I had two friends. I was involved in this organization of adults who were working with kids who wanted to go into the business world. And we would go to these meetings. It was called JA, God, I forget the name, juvenile something, but anyway. So my good friend, my best friend started to get high, and he was smoking weed, and oh my God, that was a pretty terrible thing to do then. White kids weren't smoking weed. If you were a jazz musician, you smoked weed, I guess. But white kids weren't, and he and this other guy in my school tried to get me to turn on, and they start getting high on opiates, and it was like, so for a couple of months, I said, no, no, no. And then one Sunday, my drug of choice besides alcohol at that time was wine, because it was cheap and it was fast. And the cheaper, the better. Tiger Rose, Boone's Farm, whatever it was, that was it. You know, open the top, and in 3 minutes, it was all down and got that rush. So I didn't have any. I didn't have enough this one Sunday. So I thought, okay, well, I'll try it. Well, that was the beginning, and I really don't talk that much about this happened and that happened and gory stories. A few instances, maybe I'll mention the point about that Sunday afternoon. Within a week, by the following Sunday, I was using every day. You know, it wasn't like I chipped once in a while or I did it once in a while. No, man, you know, every day after a week, I could not stop. It just grabbed onto those synapses and like, boom, you know, so damn powerful and wouldn't let me go. The obsession compulsion was there. And I think about that every morning, about the obsession compulsion of my active use, and what it was like, and that was it. That was it. You know, there were rainy days, sunny days, whatever, snowy days, cold weather, warm weather, spring, fall, whatever it was, I just used every day and couldn't stop. My primary goal, I think, during my addiction was this was rather ridiculous. After I got clean, I thought about it. My days were spent by nodding off in a chair with drooling out of my mouth, cigarette in hand. I smoked cigarettes during my addiction, and just, you know, if that was your addiction, you know, nodding out and your hand would just drop and you would burn holes in your jeans, and that was it. That was my existence, copping, getting, you know, trying to nod out and then copping again. So my goal was to take the guys that I hung around with, and there were 5 or 10. There were, you know, how it is when you're getting high, I guess, for most people. My goal was to and this was in the 60s, and I was reading a lot of leftist, communist, socialist material. I thought I was a genius. I'd gotten into college, and so I was reading all this Che Guevara stuff and Fidel and everything, and it was very romantic to me. I thought, oh God, how lovely. You know, so I wanted to get my friends, and there were mountains about an hour and a half, 2 hours outside of Philadelphia called the Pocono Mountains. And my goal was to get these guys, these 5 or 10 guys, and we were going to head up to the mountains, and we were going to start a revolution. There were two problems with that idea and that scheme. First of all, the guys like me were nodding out too, and they were in no condition to start anything, much less a revolution. And second of all, and maybe more important, we don't have a gun. So how are you going to start a revolution if you don't have guns, and you need people with level, you know, clear minded? And we had neither. So that was the extent of, you know, it was a fantasy world. You know, it was, and I can still have fantasies in my life and just think of things that really will never happen. So with all that being said, my family got involved with me getting high, and they have to do something. So at that time, there were only two places in the United States where you could go other than the mental hospital if you had an opiate addiction. And that was one in Lexington, Kentucky. It was called the Narcotic Farm in Lexington, Kentucky. And the federal government ran it. The other place you could go to was a place in California called Synanon. And you might want to Google this. Synanon has a premier place in the recovery movement in the United States. Synanon, after AA and NA, Synanon was an organization where people went, and basically the goal, you were going to stay there the rest of your life, and they took care of you. You had to work, and they had some businesses that they ran, and they had therapy. And the therapy was confrontive therapy. It was first therapeutic community in the world. And it was attack therapy. And man, they would just go after you and attack you and just tear you down. And the problem was they didn't know how to build you up. They would just, you know, take you down to bare bone. And I saw this and I thought, you know, this is not for me. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be attacked. I don't want to be hollered at. As I came back to Philadelphia after a short while, and then I went up to a place called Daytop Village. It was in Staten Island. The people in New York had heard of Synanon in California, and they thought it'd be a great idea to start a therapeutic community in New York, and they started Daytop Village. And that was the same thing, man, you know, they went after you. And then Philadelphia heard about Daytop Village, and they started something called Gaudentia. So that was the beginnings, until there was a hospital that opened right outside of Philadelphia called Eagleville Hospital. Originally had been a tuberculosis hospital. And the guy, doctor who ran it, came up with this idea of turning it into a alcohol rehab. And then he had another idea of putting drug addicts with alcoholics in treatment. That was rather stupid. No one did that. Why would you put alcoholics and people addicted to other drugs together? The concept was unique. It was worldwide. You know, it changed the face of recovery. And Don Ottenberg was his name, the doctor, the CEO. And I ended up going to this place after being in every mental hospital in Philadelphia area. And I had to get off the street because, man, I thought I was going to get busted. I had scripts out. It was like, oh, this is not good. This is not good. I had the one or two little encounters. It was, oh man, how to get off the streets. I went to this place called Igloo, April 25th, 1971. Attended my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I didn't know it at the time, but the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting outside of California was at this place, Igloo Hospital. At the time, there were only 20 meetings in the world. Not in your neighborhood, not in your city, not in your country. There were 21 meetings in the world, and they were all in California. Well, a guy by the name of Roy P., who lived half the time in Philadelphia area and half the time in California, was visiting his father in California. Now, Roy had stopped using. He was going to this famous AA clubhouse in Philadelphia called the Young Men's. And Young Men's were, it was like, the bottom. You know, if you had an alcohol problem, they took you in. If you had a drug problem, they took you in. But it was an AA clubhouse. And Roy went to California. Well, he was an AA. And this is in the history books of NA, if you are interested. And there's a great site, by the way, and I urge you, please jot this down. It's called carrythemessage.com. Carrythemessage.com. It is loaded with information about the founding of AA in California, the founding of AA outside of California, which began in Philadelphia, and all over the world. Carrythemessage.com. You will just salivate. It will take you hours and hours and days to go through the material. It is absolutely amazing. And I know the two people who put it together, and it was a labor of love. So anyway, Roy's out in California, and he meets this guy named Jimmy Kay. This guy's his name, Jimmy Kinnon. Now you talk about coincidence. Oh, and by the way, you know, my higher power has blessed me with being at certain places, certain times, to witness history and the development of NA. And one of them was being at Eagleville Hospital, where NA began outside of California. So Roy meets this guy named Jimmy Kinnon. And Jimmy Kinnon and Roy start talking, and Roy says to Jimmy, well, I'm going to go back to Philadelphia. Now listen to this. This is amazing. I just got chills. So Jimmy Kinnon hands Roy the little white book. And he said to Roy, why don't you go back to Philadelphia and why don't you start a meeting? Can you fucking imagine? Pardon my cursing, but it's like mind-boggling that Roy would meet this guy, Jimmy Kay. He came back to Philadelphia. He went to this AA Young Men's Club. And there was this guy at the AA Club whose name was Dick F. Dick was an alcoholic. He was in AA. And Dick worked at Eagleville as a therapist. And Dick said to Roy, come on up to AA, I mean, come on up to Eagleville, the rehab, and I'll talk to my boss and see if we could start a meeting. So Roy and Dick go up to Eagleville, go in and meet with Don Ottenberg, the guy who revolutionized the concept of putting an alcohol and drug addict together, and said, yes. There it is, you know, two points of our history, putting drug addicts and alcoholics together and allowing the first meeting outside of California. So I figure at that time there were probably, what, maybe 200 people in NA. If you have 20 meetings, maybe 10 home group members at most of each meeting. So the first meeting was at Eagleville, and I show up, and there's this AA thing. It's like, wow. So I spent, I don't know, 5-6 months at Eagleville. In those days, you could spend a long time. And they had a halfway house program. I went into that. I didn't complete the halfway house program. I just completed half of it. And around September of 71, I got out. I went through the phone book because I went to find an NA meeting. Because I didn't know anything about NA. I didn't know anything about A other than I went to, there were lots of AA meetings at Eagleville and one NA meeting. And there wasn't anything about NA in the phone book. I saw AA. And I called this AA clubhouse, and here you go. Here you go. God putting me at a certain place on a certain time. Guy answered the phone at this AA clubhouse, Jim S. I told him I had just gotten out of Eagle that day and was looking for a meeting. And Jim said to me, I'm going to quote exactly what he said to me in 1971. He said, I have two sons who are in this new thing called Narcotics Anonymous. I have two sons who are in this new thing called Narcotics Anonymous, September 1971. He said, come on down to the AA clubhouse tonight and you can meet my two sons. Well, I went down there and there they were, the first four people outside of California. Roy P., who met Jimmy K., who I talked about, who brought AA to Philadelphia. The two brothers, Danny and Mike S., and the first woman in NA outside of California, Maureen Mick. I showed up, so I became NA number 5. I was the fifth person in NA outside of California. God, I just got chills. You know, when I talk about this sometimes, I am just so blessed. I am just so blessed to have seen, like, the growth of NA. So then there's 21 meetings now, right, in the world when I show up. Now there are, it was advertised 76, I believe now it may even be up to 78,000 meetings in the world. And thank God for your format, and thank God to Zoom that allows us. You know, I've been to meetings all over, Hungary, wherever. I've been all over the world. And I am just so blessed that I've seen the beginnings of NA and up to what we have today. And I believe that people have different callings in NA. I believe some people, you know, get involved in service in area and region and do all that stuff. And that's one. There's some people who do H&I stuff. There are some people who start meetings. And that was my thing. And let me just finish this first thing about. So at that time, there was only one NA meeting in Philadelphia. And it was in actually, it was outside of Philadelphia in Springfield, Delaware County, and it was in a school, and it was on the second floor. And the part in NA where it talks about, you know, the reading and whether it's Narcotics Anonymous program, it says we're under no surveillance anytime. Not true, because we were under surveillance, at least here in Philadelphia. I can vividly, in my mind, still go there and watch the police in their car outside. They didn't know what was going on. Well, they knew that there were addicts and there were five of us. And it was a little disconcerting. Okay, so I hung around these guys and we're going to a lot of AA. And thank God there were two AA groups in Philadelphia that welcomed us, because most AA meetings did not welcome us. You know, we'd walk in and women would hide their pocketbook, and there were two groups who did. And I get very angry when I hear people speak ill of AA. So I'm going to lots of AA meetings, and God, we had the white book. We didn't have area. We didn't have basic text. We didn't have Living Clean. We didn't have pamphlets. All we had was ourselves. But then I got the idea that I was cured, and I went out. And it wasn't a good thing. Came back 9, 10 months later. And now there are two more people in NA. So now there's seven of us. And those two guys were instrumental, Brian and Ray T, their brothers, they're still around today, starting literally the first two, maybe three meetings in Philadelphia outside of California, other than that one in Springfield, Delaware County. So I'm going to some meetings again, and I decide I'm cured again and went out. And that was terrible. Obviously, you know, you hear people coming in, and I came in with my tail between my legs, and it was it. Went from 179 pounds to 129 pounds that last year and a half. So the first time was April 25th, 1971, and now I came back, and my clean date is June 6th, 1974. And the one thing I resent is I admit that I wasted that time, that I don't have that time. I think a lot of people feel that way when they read. Oh, and by the way, you know, now we have nice words like relapse. Oh, he relapsed, they relapsed. You know, I fucked up. That's what they said. Jim fucked up. You know, come on, sit down, listen. You know, you weren't encouraged to share, you know, unless you got like 30 days or so. And that's the way it was. So when I finally came, now there were like a dozen of us. And the interesting thing now, the dozen of us in this area and outside of California are still clean today. I doubt if 100 people who come in to NA today in any part of the world would be clean 40, 45, 50 years ongoing. My calling was to start meetings. With my higher power, I started a dozen meetings. I started two areas. I started a country. I founded NA in Iceland in December 1982. And that's one of the beauties of for me of getting clean, was discovering things. I discovered travel. Like I said, I never got out of a chair for 10 and a half years. I discovered travel. And I went to Iceland a few times. I loved it. And at that time, I was in school. And unfortunately, I went to that. That was another thing about getting clean to me. Like, people like were doing things like getting jobs and having, you know, my job history was 1 week, you know, getting money and going on a run. That was my job. So people like, you know, my first sponsor, Danny, one of the two brothers, He had the job for like 6 months or a year. It was like, wow. So I got jobs. And then I saw some people going to school, and I went to school, and I got some initials in back of my name. I'm very, very fortunate. I've been in healthcare even before I got clean in medicine for 55 years, and I started as an orderly and worked my way up. And I have two initials after my name, licensed in two states, and I'm very fortunate that I picked occupations. I can go anywhere and literally get jobs anywhere in the world. So I worked in Iceland, and I lived in Iceland from 82 and 83. Then the following year, wound up in Denmark, and had to have major surgery within 24 hours. And I knew what I had. I knew I had to have surgery. It was a matter of whether having it in Copenhagen, where I just ended up, and I had a contact in Copenhagen, the doctor, because I was going out with a Danish woman in the Philadelphia area, and I had an operation. And the day of the operation, after I came out of anesthesia, I was able to go to this little area where you could smoke, and at this Danish hospital, and this Danish nurse came over, and we started talking. And within 2 weeks, I moved in with this Danish nurse, and it was the greatest, the greatest, the greatest, the greatest pre-addiction, post-addiction recovery of my life. The greatest week of my life was spent with my Danish girlfriend in the forest in Norway. It was deserted. It was right before it was a cabin at the ski resort where there were about 10 cabins, and it was probably like October, November before skiing season began, and it was just her and I for a week together. It was the thing that you could write a novel or a film about. It was the greatest, greatest week of my life. And I'm not just, I've said that for years. I see her from time to time. We chat from time to time. We send him, we connect after a while. But anyway, okay. So I ended up back in the States. So now it's somewhere around 85. I met a woman, a nurse. We got married. We moved to New Jersey. I have three daughters. And I just carried on what I did in Philadelphia. I started a bunch of meetings. I'd started that area down there. The marriage just ended. There was nothing to it. I think most marriages end because of drugs, alcohol, gambling, or fooling around. Mine basically was none of those. It was just the marriage just dried up. It was over. So I left the marriage. And the year before I left and came moved back to Philadelphia, the worst medical event of my life. An event very, very similar to COVID. I contacted someone, sneezed on me, or coughed on me, or touched something, and I developed this condition called empyema, not emphysema, empyema. What that is, that's pus in one of the layers of your lung, and it went throughout my body. I became septic, apparently, and I only know what I'm going to tell you now because I've read it and people have told me. I was on a vent. I was in ICU for a week. At the end of 21, 22 days, I don't know anything. I had maybe a hazy recollection. I had to go to physical rehab to learn how to walk again. So I'm a miracle. I'm a miracle that I made it in. Then I'm a miracle in 2007, 2008 that I recuperate and learn how to walk again. And now I'm much better than before. People say, well, I'm 100% better. I am 100% better because I worked very hard in the beginning. I continue to work hard to stay healthy. Okay. So I don't know. That's probably it. That's the end. I've gone for like 40 minutes. That's about it. Okay, so I do four things. Have only done four things. I keep it very, very simple, and I mean very, very simple. We were talking a little bit, Jay and Steve and I, about AA before the meeting began. And Dr. Bob, according to my AA memory, Dr. Bob always used to tell Bill Wilson, "Keep it simple, keep it simple." And when I came in, it was "Keep it simple, keep it simple." And now, 40 some years later, it's "Keep it simple, keep it simple." So this is how I keep it simple. I have something to keep me clean in the morning. Whatever that is, higher power, God, I know what it is to me. That's I have something. At night, I thank that something for keeping me clean, and I do a tenth at that time also. I go to the meetings regularly, and that has fluctuated and varied throughout the years. One meeting, 2 meetings a week, 7 meetings, whatever it was. I go to meetings regularly, and the fourth thing I do, If somebody wants something, I'll do it. They call that 12-step work. And listen, I've really liked, have enjoyed this. And thank you for letting me share. I'm sorry if I bored you. God, thank you. It's been a privilege. Thank you. I'm done.